KALW.
Those murals represent a moment because they were so spontaneous for the most part.
Some of the most powerful art in Oakland isn't on a canvas in a gallery. It's on plywood covering store windows. Many of these temporary murals honor the memories of Black people killed by police. We'll find out what happens to the art when the plywood comes down.
We wanted to make sure that it was held for Black people and for Blacks to decide.
Then we'll hear about an Instagram account that chronicles experiences of racism at a Bay Area high school.
If it helps even one person feel heard or comforted or less alone, then I'll have at least accomplished that small thing.
And we meet a man who's working to keep a movie theater alive during the pandemic.
The art house theaters, we're used to being creative.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. There's been some changes to the general landscape of downtown Oakland in the past few months. There are lots of murals, more than 1,000 in total, and they're painted on the plywood that businesses use to cover their storefronts during anti-police brutality protests back in June. These murals were painted by an assortment of Bay Area artists, and they've brought a lot of color to the area. But what exactly is going to happen to them after they come down? KALW's Babette Thomas has that story.
Over the past few months, downtown Oakland has looked different. I'm from Oakland, but I've been at school on the East Coast for the past 4 years. And when I came back home this past summer, I noticed lots and lots of murals, more than I'd ever seen. These murals stretch from 7th Street all the way up past 20th Street, scattered on main streets and side streets. There are ornate portraits of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. There are paintings listing and honoring the names of Black people who've been killed by police. And there are other murals with phrases like Set Us Free and Black Lives Matter, like one at the corner of 12th and Franklin on the side of a shop called Pacific Range Hoods.
It's a black and white portrait of an African person with like kind of Eastern African features, and it says Black Lives Matter ! In an arc over the top.
This is Blaine Asrat. She's the artist who painted this mural back in early June. She's based in San Francisco, but when she heard about some of the damage done to businesses in downtown Oakland after anti-police brutality protests, her and her friends decided to come help out with a group called Bay Area Cleanup. Except when she got there,
they were like, oh, you know, most of the cleanup's actually already done.
So instead, Blaine was told to paint white over some graffiti on the plywood that businesses use to cover up their storefronts.
And so we just looked around and we found the first open sheet of plywood because there was a ton of artists already painting murals. And like, it was, I had no idea that that was going to be happening. And I was like, oh, I can't really just paint a whiteboard and leave. Like, this is too good of an opportunity. So I just started drawing, and then that was pretty much it. I had no plan to do it, but the opportunity just presented itself.
Blaine is used to working solo in an art school studio. This felt different.
Those murals represent a moment because they were so spontaneous for the most part, and it was such a community thing of like mostly East Bay folks, of which I'm not one, but it was just like I could see there was so much solidarity there.
In many ways, these murals are physical reminders of this historic moment, of the pandemic and Black Lives Matter. Now the question is, how do you preserve these murals, these objects that encapsulate this moment? Carolyn Johnson, or CJ, has been trying to answer this question.
I'm CJ, Executive Director of the East Oakland Black Cultural Zone Collaborative.
The Black Cultural Zone is a collective of organizations, businesses, and residents trying to uphold the presence of Black people and Black culture in East Oakland. And a couple months ago, some of the murals started being buffed over and taken down without the artist's consent. So CJ got involved.
So I began to make a few calls to the city of Oakland and a couple other folks, and wound up getting connected with the group we're working with. And we wanted to make sure that it was held for Black people and for Blacks to decide. So we stayed engaged in the process with these groups.
And this group that CJ is talking about, it's a mix of local arts and cultural organizations collaborating to preserve these murals. The Black Cultural Zone is leading the effort with the support of organizations like the Spirit Works Foundation, the Oakland Art Murmur, and the Oakland Museum of California. Here's the Oakland Museum's director and CEO, Lori Fogarty.
Early on, we connected with the Black Cultural Zone and very much have positioned ourselves as being available with the resources and the staff and the expertise that we have to do whatever we can to support this effort.
And the idea that this group of organizations came up with, free online and in-person programming where people can engage with these murals through public installations and conversations with the artists. It's part of an initiative called Art for the Movement. According to CJ, these events are all leading up to an exhibition where the murals will be installed at Eastmont Mall in East Oakland. This show, tentatively scheduled for the end of this year, will take viewers on a journey through Oakland's history of protests. Ending with this latest wave.
The majority of Black people in Oakland live in East Oakland. And again, we never really see. The art did not make its way down to, and we think that message of how it makes Black people feel that there are so many folks who acknowledge what's going on, that they care, and that they're upset about it, means something to people that you're cared about. And if you don't see it, you don't know.
But before any exhibition, a few things need to happen. First, the Black Cultural Zone needs to determine who painted these murals, which is tricky because some of them are anonymous. So the Black Cultural Zone has been working with local artists to put together the pieces of this puzzle, hosting conversations over Zoom, scouring Instagram, and doing field research downtown. After the Black Cultural Zone helps identify the artists of a mural, they also have to figure out who exactly owns them. Here's CJ again.
The creative work of art is something that's copyrightable, belongs to the artist. The board belongs to the person who acquired the board. The window on which the board is placed is a building that is owned by somebody. So there are potentially three claims to ownership of the board for different reasons. We try to understand all three of those parties and to make sure that all three of those parties are informed, and that negotiation is between them.
They then coordinate the transportation and the storage of the mural until the exhibition. There are lots of steps to make sure that these boards are publicly exhibited. But if there's one thing that CJ knows for sure, it's that down the line, she doesn't want to see these works hanging up on a wall in a restaurant.
Someone's life was lost. The breath was literally pushed out of his body while he called for his mama as he died for public view. And so in no way should what happened be privatized. It belongs to the world. It belongs to the community as a story that needs to be told forever so that that will never happen again.
CJ and the Black Cultural Zone Collaborative are making sure that Black people and Black artists in Oakland, particularly in East Oakland, not only hear this story, but also have a say in how it's told. In Oakland, I'm Babette Thomas for Cross Currents.
Today at 6 p.m., the Black Cultural Zone will be hosting a virtual conversation honoring the artists who painted these murals. We'll have a link at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba.
Many young people of color are faced with racism every day, whether it's blatant and in your face or subtler microaggressions. And yes, it's happening even in our liberal Bay Area. One example that was in the news happened 3 years ago when a group of non-Black students at Albany High School created a racist Instagram account, attacking fellow Black students with racial slurs, depicting them as gorillas and hanging from nooses. The incident shook the school and the city. The students who made the account, plus those who liked or commented on the posts, they were all suspended. And when they came back to school, they were met with demonstrators and a student body that was outraged. The students' families filed a lawsuit claiming the school doled out a punishment that was too harsh and that they feared for the children's safety. The school settled with the families for over $500,000. Natalie Johnson is a former Albany High student. She graduated before that incident, but her younger sister was there during all the controversy. Natalie says racism at the school wasn't new, and she recently launched the Instagram account Black at Albany for current students to share their stories. I talked to her and first asked what she thought when her sister first told her what had happened.
I remember when I heard about the incident, she told me about it. We were horrified, you know, and we thought it was disgusting, but we weren't at all surprised. We were just very disappointed, very hurt, but not surprised.
Why were you kind of disappointed, but not surprised?
I think just my high school experience, and all of the discrimination, racism, microaggressions that I faced, just made it very clear to me that Albany is not very welcoming to Black students and Black families.
Can you talk about your time at Albany High School as a young Black woman and what kinds of things would happen to you? You wrote an op-ed about this called Reflections on Being Black in a So-Called Liberal Area. And so can you take us through a couple of the things that you witnessed personally?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of these things were very small comments, but they just added up over time, I think, and really, really impacted my self-esteem and how I saw myself almost. So when I told people that I lived with just my mom and my sister, they assumed that my dad was out of the picture or that I just didn't know him at all, which is very far from the truth. My parents are just divorced, like half of America. When I raised my hand to speak in class, people would say things like, "Oh, you're so well-spoken. Why don't you talk Black?" People would try to touch my hair, ask me if it was real, ask me if I had to curl it. When I took AP classes or did well on an assignment, people would say things like, "I didn't know you were smart." And this one, I will never really forget. I remember I got my SAT test results back and I studied really hard. I took like prep classes on the weekends, that kind of thing. And I did way better than I expected. I was so excited, and I was at this, I think, swim team meeting, something like that. And, you know, I was talking about my score, and this boy said, "Oh, you got over 2,000. I thought you were retarded."
So then fast forward kind of to this Instagram page. Tell me about it. Tell me why you wanted to start this, even though you were out of the school.
So I saw this thread on Twitter, but it was someone who had been at the school at the time of the incident and who I guess had kind of, you know, this student perspective on what happened. And so I remember seeing this thread, you know, 3 years later, and I was like, oh my God, nothing has changed here in the 10 years since I started at that high school. Absolutely nothing has changed. And then I saw that all of these Instagram accounts started popping up, like Black at USC, Black at Harvard, Black at Yale, and then high schools too. And I was kind of like, nobody else is doing this. And I think, you know, someone needs to do it. So I guess I'll do it. And I also kind of figured that the kids who are still in school were probably scared. The ones who recently graduated probably wanted to get as far away from that place as possible, as I did. So I thought, you know, I'll just try it. I'll see what happens. And if it helps even one person feel heard or comforted or less alone, then I'll have at least accomplished that small thing.
So then you launch it, and then what happens? You start getting these stories, and I'm looking at the page right now. You know, it's just very sad. There are posts here as recent as, I mean, this person is class of 2020, right? Somebody who just graduated just now. Class of 2021. Tell me a little bit about the stories that you started to see popping up on the account.
It was really, really hard. I just want to say, having to read all of these stories over and over again while creating the posts. But again, I just felt that it was important and something I needed to do. One story that really, really stuck out to me was this girl wrote in, and it didn't happen at the high school. It happened when she was in elementary school. She was 9 in the 3rd grade, and they were learning about the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King Jr. And she comes from a mixed family, had parents of different races. I'm guessing that one must have been black and one must have been white. And she said that the teacher looked at her and said, if we were back in that time, then your parents would have been lynched.
Mm.
To a 9-year-old. That was one where I was just like, I don't understand how anyone could think that there isn't a problem here, that this is the way we are speaking to children.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Another one that really stood out to me was this girl wrote in about how in middle school, again, not at the high school, but in middle school, a teacher told her that her hair was distracting, called her attire ghetto, and made her move to the back of the classroom.
And through this giving other people a voice, do you feel this is healing for you?
In many ways, it was healing, just to kind of, I guess, get my story out, have other people able to share their stories and use their voice. But it has also been very challenging, very emotionally taxing. Just, you know, every time I get an email from the email account that I made with a notification that someone else has filled out the form, I'm just like, oh God, like, here we go again with something horrible that this school in this town has put a child through. And it's just, it's disheartening. But I'm hopeful that through seeing all of these stories and hearing these accounts from students, that people are finally, really going to be active in making a change.
Natalie Johnson is creator of the Black at Albany Instagram account. Thanks to B. Soul for producing that interview. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. With everything that's been happening this year, sometimes 2020 feels like we're living in a bad movie. And with the coronavirus, theaters are feeling it too. Regal Cinemas, the second largest movie theater chain, recently announced they were temporarily closing all 536 of their U.S. theaters this week because of the pandemic. Smaller theaters are fighting to survive too. Derek Zemrak is a film producer and owner of the Orinda Theater. The 79-year-old venue not only screens films, but hosts intimate live concerts. Derek is trying to keep the theater afloat with fundraisers and virtual events. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with him about his love for film and the future of the film industry.
You've done everything. Maybe not quite, but almost everything. producing movies, starting a film festival, buying a movie theater. When did Cupid hit you with the movie arrow?
Actually, the first time that I decided I really wanted to make movies was when I was a kid. And I actually saw The Champ, which was a John Voight film. And I remember that movie, and it hit me so much. And I go, I want to do that someday. I want to make people cry. So that ending of that movie was so heavy. It's like, that's the kind of movies I want to make someday. So
how old were you then?
I was probably 9-10 years old.
What was it like producing your first film?
Well, my first film was very bad.
Is that the ice cream?
Yeah, yes. Okay. You did your research. When we did that, that's when Ed Wood started to take off, you know, with the Johnny Depp film, and everyone was interested in low-budget movies. And then all of a sudden, my movie got listed in the LA Times as one of the worst movies ever made. So it kind of catapulted, you know, the next one. I was made a movie and I'd call distributors and they'd be like, oh, you're the one who did that ice cream film? And it's like, so they heard about it in a negative way, but it kind of helped. So.
You know, you're a businessman, and 15 years ago you bought the Orinda Theater?
Actually 12.
12, okay. And I know I've read that you don't make a profit from it. So why buy a theater?
Like I said, you know, later on in my life, you know, I really wanted to do something for the community and I wanted to do something that I was passionate about. And I thought that's one way that I can give back and be able to give people a place to go. I mean, there's so much, you know, that people have fond memories at movie theaters. And, you know, in the Orinda, we also do, you know, cabaret shows and right. lectures and we do all kinds of things. So it's like all of the arts are thrown into one little house. So it is nice. You know, they always say your volunteer positions are more stressful than your actual day jobs. But you have to be passionate about it. And that's what we have. And that's what we've been able to accomplish. So.
Wow. So you've had it for 12 years. You've had it. What has been like just one of the high points of owning this theater?
You know, every year we have the film festival, so we never know who's showing up to the film festival. You know, we had Helen Hunt a few years ago, which was, you know, fantastic. We've had Richard Dreyfuss. But I think one of the most memorable ones in recent years would have been Rita Moreno, who's been to the theater many times. She lives in, you know, in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And Rita, you know, performed in our Live at Orinda cabaret series, and she kicked off our season. And it was just remarkable to see, you know, such a legend that, you know, has won all those awards to be able to be on our stage and perform. Whereas before, she's done Q&As for us. You know, she's just come to be a moviegoer. But this was actually to watch her perform, and everybody was just astonished to see, you know, Oscar, Emmy, Tony, Grammy Award winner on stage performing right in front of you. And we do the cabaret series in our 198-seat theater, so there's only 14 rows. So it's up close and personal.
It's intimate.
And that's what cabaret is all about, that people are moved with it.
For me, when I'm stressed out, one of the first places I go to, aside from my therapist, is the movie theater and live music venues too, right? Like I just wanted to sit in a dark room, listen to some good music, or just like get lost in a story. But because of the pandemic, people are streaming now. Do you think, and are people in your industry talking about this is going to be the future, that we're going to be watching movies when they come out, when they're released from home?
You know, Mulan is going, you know, to streaming. You know, you have to have Disney Plus and it's $29.95, you know. So how many people are really going to do that?
Right.
And you also have Tenet, who's a big movie with a Chris Nolan film that directed, that's coming out in movie theaters in states that can have movie theaters open. So it's kind of a big test. If it's a home run for Disney with Mulan, you're going to see other studios follow suit. Piracy, you know, in every art, you know, but if it's music or if it's film, you have piracy issues. And that's the other thing that's hitting movie theaters, you know, another bump on the head is really, you know, the piracy. Because if they're going, you know, overseas releasing the movies, there's going to be people who are going to copy them. And it's happening now. It's already online. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize, like, the studios don't just front the money of, you know, $200 million to make the movie. They borrow the money. So if the debt is due, they got to start paying it. So it's like one way or another. If, you know, if they Bank of America loaned them the money and they're, you know, they said, well, we're going to release it in July. Okay, your payments are going to start in August. And they don't release it. Where's that money coming from? I mean, they've got to start digging into their pockets. You listen to other movie theaters, you know, they're like, oh, you know, the multiplexes will bounce back sooner. And I disagree with that. When we get the go ahead, you know, if the governor says, okay, you know, Contra Costa County, you can now open, and Contra Costa County agrees to it, I can make a phone call and I can book, you know, six different performances. I can do a live concert, I could do comedy, I could do a, you know, a one man, you know, a person's play, I could do lectures, I could do all kinds of stuff to get it, you know, make phone calls easily. And I think these, the big chains who took their seats down from 250 seats down to 75 seats because they got these big comfy luxury seats, they're going to have 12 people. You know, you can't make it at 12 people, you know? So it's like, we're in a position, I think, in the short term, I think independent theaters are going to be able to bounce back quicker than multiplexes because they're going to be looking at each other like going, what? You know, it is a really trying time at this point to see if movies theaters will ever come back. I feel like the art house theaters, we're used to alternative programming. We're used to being creative.
That was filmmaker Derek Zemrak speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. To learn more about the Orinda Theater's virtual events, go to our website, kelw.org. And that's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast and hear all our stories anytime you want. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.